Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Clayton Boyce, and I'm president of the National Press Club and news editor for Knight Ridder Tribune News Service. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On Thursday, September 16th, Senator Paul Simon will discuss his legislation to curb violence on television. On Tuesday, September 21st, Attorney Elmer Johnson, American business expert, will discuss the future of the large corporation in a fast-changing environment. And on Wednesday, September 22nd, Judith Martin, otherwise known as Ms. Manners, will talk about the etiquette of the press. I didn't know we had one, actually. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include the Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, Secretary of Defense, Les Aspin, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Colin Powell, and Chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, John Dingell. I'd like to remind you that audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them up to me. I'll ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. Please withhold your applause until all the names are read. From your right, Mark Stang, author of Rosters, a reference book on Major League Baseball. George Will, columnist and author of Men at Work. Stephen Smith, news editor, Knight Ridder Newspapers. Kathy Kiley, Washington bureau chief, of the Houston Post, I'm sorry. Mike Christensen, Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Bill Headline, Washington Bureau Chief, Cable News Network. Representative Cynthia McKinney, representative from Georgia's 11th District. Mr. Andrew Price, banquet captain, National Press Club, who's been handling these luncheons for many years for us, and we're glad to have him here today. Ike Pappas, president of the Ike Pappas Network Productions, and member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee, who arranged today's luncheon. Kay Coit of the Washington Post, 5 days a week. She's a copy editor in the sports department. 7 days a week, she's married to me. Kevin Keene of Thompson Newspapers. Peter Blank, assistant editor, Kiplinger Tax Letter. Reginald Stewart, assistant news editor, Knight Ridder Newspapers, and chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. John Fogarty, editor of the Kiplinger California Letter and past president of the National Press Club. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, and Melanie Abdo-Dermott for organizing today's luncheon. Henry Hank Aaron was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame on the first ballot in 1982. He was a giant of the game and has grown even bigger since his retirement. He is now a very successful businessman with a passion for improving the quality of life in the United States. Even the casual baseball fan knows that Hank Aaron holds the record for the most home runs in a career. He broke that unbreakable record of Babe Ruth of 714 home runs in 1974. And he went on to hit a total of 755 home runs in his career. Most fans don't know, however, that he also holds more major league batting records than any other player in the game's history. He holds the records for most runs batted in, total bases, extra base hits, and plate appearances. He played for 23 years and appeared in 24 All-Star games. How does that happen? I know I should have proofread this. He was the first player ever to record more than 3,000 hits and 500 homers, and he achieved both of these goals while still in his prime, years before he retired. He began as a teenage shortstop in the Negro Leagues and then came to the major leagues as an outfielder with the Milwaukee Braves in 1954. By 1957, he was the National League's most valuable player. Mickey Mantle called him the best player of my era. Bobby Thompson, the hero of the 1951 Giants' miracle comeback over the Dodgers, and later a teammate on the Milwaukee Braves, said that magic is the only word I can use to describe him. Kurt Simmons, a hard-throwing left-hander for the Philadelphia Phillies, described the plight of all major league pitchers of his era when he complained that it's easier to sneak the sun past a rooster than to throw a fastball past Hank Aaron. For more than two decades, there was an unspoken rule in the majors. If you want to win, make sure there's nobody on base when you pitch to Hank Aaron. Major League Baseball has recently established the Hank Aaron RBI Award to be presented annually to the RBI leaders in the National and American Leagues. Since he retired as an active player in 1977, Henry Aaron has been even more successful. He is currently Corporate Vice President of Community Relations for the Turner Broadcasting System and a member of the TBS Board of Directors. He is Senior Vice President and Assistant to the President of the TBS-owned Atlanta Braves, and in that capacity has helped develop the talent that has made the Braves' farm system the best in baseball. He also serves as Vice President of Business Development for the Airport Channel, which provides customized news and information programming at airports throughout the United States. He is perhaps most proud, however, of his contributions to society. In addition to being involved with the Boy Scouts and the NAACP, he is the spokesman for Arby's Hank Aaron Big Brothers Big Sister Scholarship Fund, which has raised $5 million for disadvantaged youth. Additionally, he sponsors the Hank Aaron Rookie League, which offers inner-city youth the opportunity to participate in organized sports programs and provides one-on-one tutoring so that these athletes may excel in school as well. He is also a member of the Sterling Committee of Morehouse College in Atlanta, and he and his wife, Billy, personally sponsor two students at the Morehouse School of Medicine. Mr. Aaron has been and continues to be a strong proponent of more minority representation in the front offices of Major League Baseball. When all the players who have played Major League Baseball are listed in any compilation, the first name on the list is always Henry Aaron. The alphabet begins with A, and Major League Baseball begins with Aaron. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm proud to introduce to you a man who is truly a legend, Hank Aaron.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, it's always nice to be in Washington. When Clayton was reading out all the stats, it just reminds me of a story that I'd like to share with you. And I guess it would be appropriate to tell this story here in Washington, because right after I had hit the home run in 1974, I remember going back to my position, and our traveling secretary, Donald Davidson, who stood about this high, is no longer with us now, pardon me, come running down the left field line, and he was telling me that the president was on the telephone. And I said, "Well, fine, Donald." I said, "But what do you want me to do?" I said, just put the president on hold, and I'll be right with him. Sure enough, right after that inning was over with, I went running up the steps and answered the telephone, and President Nixon was on the phone, and he congratulated me for hitting a home run. I said, "Thank you very much, Mr. President." He said, I'd like for you to be my guest at the White House. I said, thanks again, Mr. President. And so after we finished talking, I went back to my in the dugout to take my position in the outfield. And hell, before I could get to the outfield, Watergate had got him. That's my Republican joke, but now I have to share one with the Democrat. But anyhow, you know, I had the good fortune of playing, ending my career in Milwaukee. And right after my career was over with, Ted Turner offered me a job back in Atlanta. And so I accepted it. And so when I was standing in the outfield with Phil Niekro, who do I see strutting across the outfield grass but Bert Lance? And Bert hollered at me. He said, Hank, come here. I want to talk with you for a minute. So he and I decided we'd talk a little bit. He said, you know, President Carter is getting ready to run for president, and he'd like for you to help him out and say you'd be his first guest. And we'd sit down and eat some old Southern grits and eggs and et cetera. And I said, well, fine. Well, hell, I don't have to tell you what happened to Bert. He got out of here before he even got a good seat. So if you see Bill Clinton, tell him I'm still trying to get to the White House. Well, now let's get down to the business of the day. It is rare to pick up a local sports page and get religion. But I came close last Wednesday when I read a column in the Atlanta Constitution by writer Steve Hummer. Hummer had picked what today has become a very popular target, Major League Baseball management. His summation, they, meaning Major League Baseball management, desired a ceremony ahead of baseball. Seems they have stumbled upon even a more drastic design, no commissioner at all. This has left them free to attempt reshaping the face of the sports without all the unnecessary baggage of a conscience. No, I don't have to read the Atlanta Constitution to form an opinion on Major League Baseball today. I've been in it, around it long enough to have an interesting historic perspective. But it's amazing how, instead of becoming more representative of the best this country has to offer, American favorite pastime has grown larger than life, more complicated, and certainly more controversial. Although there are many fine baseball organizations, much of the class of days gone by has disappeared. There are certainly a number of great baseball players, but many of them pay more attention to their stock portfolio than their batting average. Where did we go wrong? I'll be the last one to tell you that things were just great when I started my professional baseball career in 1952 with Sid Pollack's Indianapolis Clowns. Pollack lived in Tarrytown, New York, not Indianapolis. The Clowns didn't play in Indianapolis either. They were a barnstorming team that played everywhere. At the beginning of the season, we worked out in Winston-Salem, North Carolina a few days. I'll never forget the first day. The only equipment I had was a pair of spikes I've been wearing 3 or 4 years and a beat-up glove. One of the oldest players curled up his lips and said, "Where did you get your equipment, kid? The Salvation Army?" It was cold, so they passed out warm-up jackets, and everyone got a jacket except me. Welcome, Hank Aaron, to the world of professional baseball. The poverty and the uneven playing fields I experienced growing up in a black family of 8 kids in Mobile, Alabama, helped prepare me for tough times. In my 23 years as a professional baseball player, I had to draw on every bit of that toughness to survive. I remember the years of playing to make salary. You was paid each year based on your performance in previous years. If you did worse the succeeding year, your salary was cut the next. There were no guaranteed million-dollar contracts. I'll never forget my last game as an Atlanta Braves when, even after all the excitement of breaking Babe Ruth's record, only 11,000 people showed up at the park. Today, Thanks to new management and a winning team, almost every game is a sellout. My, how time has changed. Overall, however, the game of baseball has been good to Hank Aaron. It provided an opportunity for him to excel in his chosen career. It provided him an opportunity to support himself and his family. And it brought him fame beyond his wildest imagination. But the grand old game just ain't what she ought to be. Ought, said Webster Dictionary, means obligation, natural expectation, and logical consequences. For all of the Hank Aarons who have played baseball for them, for all of the minority firms which could have done business with them, and all of the fans who have watched them, what were the obligation, the natural expectations, and the logical consequences of Major League Baseball? I recently visited one of my old stomping grounds, Milwaukee, to speak to a group of community leaders about diversity. A word kicked around in boardrooms, council chambers, institutions, everywhere you go these days. I told the group that my years in baseball taught me how valuable diversity was to the game of baseball. When the old Negro League players began appearing in the Major League uniform after Jackie Robinson broke the color line, the game changed forever. Robinson himself once said, "Life is not important except for the impact it has on other lives." Who today can imagine baseball without the theatric of a Willie Mays, the relaxed style of a cool Papa Bell, the ageless pitching power and the humor of a Satchel Paige, or the acrobatic talent of a Jice Gibson? He was a Negro League catcher who is rumored to have hit as many as 80 home runs in one season. It is said by many that Jice Gibson could pick off a player from first from a sitting position. He was a man about whom the late, great Roy Campanella once said, "I am not even good enough to carry his job." Sure, Abner Doubleday game was a backbone of American sports, but the style that black players brought to the major leagues added flash and sparks that has helped ensure that baseball will always be one on top, will be one of the top American sports. These legends paved the way for the team of today, which reminds me of Jesse Jackson's racial rainbow. African Americans, Cubans, Puerto Ricans, and the Braves have even signed a young prospect from Australia. But what does the makeup of these baseball teams have in common with the front offices that manage them? In real term, very little. The institution that runs Major League Baseball reflect very little of the rainbow they employ to make the game prosperous and great. Shouldn't that be an obligation of Major League Baseball to reward the contribution of the rainbow by bringing its representative into management position as a matter of corporate social responsibility? Shouldn't it be the natural expectation of minority communities that they would be both equal representative in management ranks and share in the spinoff business that support Major League Baseball? Shouldn't it have been a logical consequence for Major League Baseball to implement this type of forward thinking once it began to profit from the rainbow of diverse players? For the minority players who have given their lives to the game of baseball, the opportunity to make a transition into management has traditionally been very limited. We all know, and major league stats show, that minorities are scattered throughout the major leagues in variety of management position. However, we also know that the number are so far off their potential that major league report on minority hiring should have been embarrassing. In 1987, only 2% of baseball front office position was filled by minorities. According to Major League records, there were more than 2,200 Major League front office employees at the end of 1992. Of that number, 2% of the employees was Asian Americans, up from 1% in 1988. 6% was Hispanic American, up from 3% in 1988. And 9% was African American, up from 6% in 1988. If you look at the management ranks in 1992, not including on-field staff, records show that there were 5 Asian American executives of department head compared to 3 in 1989. 16 Hispanic American in 1992 compared to 11 in 1989, and 23 African Americans in 1992 compared to 21 in 1989. Not only are these numbers small, but over a 4-year period, they show very little progress. We have all heard the theory on why this is a situation in Major League Baseball today. One, it is a reflection of the way business is done in America. Two, those who own the club have a right to call the shots. Three, minorities lack the experience and business skill to work and do business with Major League management. All of these theories aside, I believe it is management that shares the bias. Sadly, misinformed and destructive philosophy of Mark Schott and Al Campanis that keep Major League Baseball from reflecting the rainbow that has made it rich. As I said quite often, baseball on the field hasn't changed. However, many of the front offices have. They have experience and evolution. No longer are they run by people who act as they were expected. In many cases today, they are run by people who disguise their intention. Those who have been appointed to advance the case of minorities within Major League Baseball have been allowed to fail by their employers. It is my opinion that if Major League Baseball wants to succeed at what it says is value in minority participation, it must take stronger medicine. Once taken, this medicine will begin to heal management and benefit all of the minority players who have the capability and desire to advance into management once their playing days are over. What about the natural expectation of minority business community? Who want to share in the market created by Major League Baseball? Just recently, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution published a report that says that in 1993, Atlanta Braves will add $203 million to the local business community. I'm sure the economic news is similar in all cities with thriving Major League Baseball franchises. How much of that business is generated in minority communities? Once again, Major League Baseball says that the reality lags far behind where they need to be. The League Equal Opportunity Committee says in a memorandum issued this spring, and I quote, some teams have relationship with minority-owned banks and about half have implemented minority purchasing programs. But it is clear that we have not reached a satisfactory level in this area, end of quote. And what about the fans? What have they a right to expect of the grand old game as a logical consequence of years of growth, sophistication, and prosperity? Don't ask 11-year-old Zach Nelson, a diehard San Diego Padres fan, who this summer wrote to team owners, and I quote, I'm very upset because you have nerve to trade Gary Sheffield for a very bad player. You guys are stupid. I should know. I'm 11 and I'm smarter than you. End of quote. Well, of course, Zach's views on the situation in San Diego is one-sided. He doesn't have the responsibility of San Diego management and cannot be expected to understand strategy for survival. But his anxiety that of many in the San Diego area reflect how important baseball is to its fans. The level of importance that a team holds for its fans should be sobering enough for management to realize how costly it is being watched. Its decision must be weighed carefully so that those who support it can sense they are made fairly. In spite of its history, Major League Baseball has a great opportunity to change. And indeed, it has announced its intent to change. It has set goals for minority vending, charitable giving, youth and inner city baseball, baseball academies, and health insurance for surviving former Negro League players and their spouses. I would only hope that change in the future is quicker than it has been in the past. Because a generation of minority players, businessmen, and fans are falling by the wayside, each day progress balks. Steve Hummer concluded in his Atlanta column with a quote from Kennesaw Mountain Landis, "Baseball is a model for America and its future generation. It has been suggested baseball is something more than a game to an American boy. It is his training field for life work." This quote from the former baseball commissioner Landis put in clear perspective what baseball represents to America. Although black players would never have gotten the opportunity to play professional baseball with Landis as commissioner. His philosophy on the symbolic importance of the game was sound. It took his successor, Senator Albert Happy Chandler of Kentucky, to open the door in 1946 for Jackie Robinson, who, because of his strength of his character, his tenaciousness, and raw talent, paved the way for other black players to enter baseball in the summer of 1947. Jackie Roosevelt Robinson's athletic success and stoic attitude made him the bridge across whom every African-American baseball player to reach the major league has crossed. So today, 47 years later, it is time that baseball live up to its obligation, natural expectation and logical consequence to every American, particularly African American and other minorities, is entitled. As a model of what is possible, Ted Turner has done some pretty outrageous things over the many years I've worked for him and known him personally. Just after he bought the Braves, he brought me back to Atlanta when my playing days in Milwaukee was over. And I admit, many of the things he did to build and promote the team was outlandish and drew a great deal of criticism from the baseball establishment and many of the fans, however. What I value most about Ted is his courage to try something different when the old ways of doing things just didn't work. He took his players on barnstorming trips across the state and had wild promotion at the stadium to build support. He once managed a team himself, didn't do very well. And he hired a man respected by many throughout the baseball world, Bill Lucas, the first black general manager in the Major League Baseball. Lucas was the architect of Braves' 1982 National League champion team. That's a part of the Braves' history. Today, with Ted Blessing, we have been involved in training programs, placing 12 minority students each year in paid positions in different parts of the business, hiring minority doctors in both the major and minor league level, minority procurement programs, and numerous community programs such as the Hank Aaron Rookie League development, fundraising for Morris Brown College, the Atlanta Braves Foundation, Carefree, and the Grand Slam program, which challenged students to stay in school, participate in baseball fitness-related activity, and stay away from drugs. It is my fondest hope that Major League Baseball learned one great lesson from my friend Ted Turner. If you want to change the results you're getting, you got to change the things you're doing. And as my friend Jesse Jackson would say, it's morning time, Major League Baseball. time to wake up. Thank you very much.
First of all, from the list of records in the introduction, I forgot to mention the one most important, that you are the only player in baseball to play in two All-Star games in 1 year.
That's why we got to 24.
Yeah. The first question is from David, and he is 6 years old, and it says, David has to leave to go back to school. So I'm going to ask his question first. What number did you wear?
Well, actually, I wore two. Well, I started out my first year, I started wearing number 5. And I guess my seventh year in the big leagues, I started wearing number 44. And the reason I started wearing number 44, it was silly, you know, really. And the reason I started wearing number 44, I thought if the higher number I wore, the more home runs I would hit. I didn't want to get too ridiculous with that, but that's why I started wearing a larger number, really.
Some guy named Bernie wants to know, if offered to you, why would you not accept the post of Commissioner of Baseball? That's from Bernie Shaw at CNN.
Well, let me just explain this. You know, baseball, baseball is in terrible shape right now, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons why we don't have a commissioner. Because if you look around at all of the clubs, there's only a very few clubs that is not making money, but clubs are able to continue to stay on top. The things that bother me, and I guess I'm frustrated by it, is the fact that you look at clubs like the one I mentioned in my speech, San Diego, and you look at clubs like Seattle, you look at the small market clubs that is not able to compete with some of the superstation clubs. I think you're going to always have this where you have the haves and the have-nots. You know, it's totally ridiculous when I listen to people write about or talk about why they traded a guy like Gary Sheffield to the Florida Marlins. Now, Gary Sheffield, to me, a year ago, was almost about to win the Triple Crown, and he's only about 25 years old. And yet they tell me, like I'm supposed to be stupid, that they're trying to build the club around somebody younger. Gary Sheffield can't be no. I mean, if you got somebody that's almost winning a Triple Crown, you got to try to build your club around him. Now, I can see them trading McGriff, but I certainly didn't see them trading Gary Sheffield.
What specifically would you do to encourage owners to hire more blacks as managers and general managers?
Well, I think once, if you look at the World Series last year, which Cito Gaston won the World Series, and I don't think anybody talk about whether you're black or white, you know. I think that if a player have the ability, no matter whether he is capable of managing or being a general manager, whatever position he may play in the big leagues, I think he ought to be given the opportunity. I don't think that you can judge anyone, for example, just because he's black or whatever. I think you have to give a person an opportunity. I think if Cito Gaston had not had the opportunity to manage the club, I don't think that the club would have done well. On the other hand, I think you look at a club like Montreal Expos last year, where Lou took over the ball club. They were almost out of the pennant race, and yet he brought them right up to chasing the team that won it, and that was Pittsburgh Pirates. So I think that if you base a person on his ability rather than basing him on his color, I think that baseball would do good by doing that.
What teams have a good record in improving the diversity of its management?
Well, I mentioned one. You know, I look at not on-field staff, as I mentioned before. I think that the Braves have done an excellent job, and I say that not because I'm a member of the ball club, but I know since myself and Ruby Lucas have been part of that Ted's organization, I know we have tried to bring in more minorities. And I'm not talking about on-field staff. We've tried to get the team and the company involved in things like Morris Brown College, raising money for Morris Brown, helping kids to come into the organization and giving them an opportunity to work as a PR department and going all year for Morris Brown from the AU Center, doing things that probably they would not ordinarily have a chance to do. So I would say that as far as I'm concerned, I don't know. You know, that's one of the things I think that Major League Baseball has hit very carefully. They don't talk about what they've done, so that's why I don't think they've done anything. So I think that if you look at the overall picture, I think that the Braves, I would have to say, has done more in that department than anybody that I can think of, any club, rather.
Which do you think that we will see first, a black baseball commissioner or a black president of the United States? And do you think we'll live to see either?
I hope I live to see one of them. Yeah, I think that there's a possibility for all of these things to happen. I'm very optimistic that anything in this country can happen, but I just don't feel like people are satisfied with what's going on. I believe that that if you look at, just take baseball, for example. If you take baseball, I think that you have several outstanding candidates that probably would be excellent for a commissioner of baseball. I know in talking to Mr. Bartholomew, I think that he has expressed some interest in everybody. You know, I'm sure that they have interviewed most, a lot of people. As far as the President of the United States, I'll let the politician handle that. I vote for whomever I think is the best candidate myself.
Are the efforts of the Reverend Jesse Jackson and demonstrations at ballparks hurting or helping the quest for better minority representation in baseball?
I think Jesse has done a great job. I welcome Jesse. You know, I think that whatever he's shown, I think is we need it. You know, we need to demonstrate and need to let people know that things are just not as good as people may think they are. You know, baseball still have some serious problems. And when you talk about some of the problems, we talk about the campaigners and some of the March shot things, you know, it's totally ridiculous when you have people this era we're talking about that make remarks and say things that hate other groups of people. I think that when Jesse can come out and voice his opinion, I think he's done a wonderful job. I think he's done a great job, and I will advise him to continue to do whatever he's been doing.
Why has there been a drop-off in interest in baseball among inner-city youth?
Well, there's a long story about that. One reason for that is because, as you know, for you to carry a family of three or four to a baseball game, it costs you an awful lot of money to go to a baseball game if you're not sitting in the Bob Uecker seats, which is out in the boondocks somewhere, you know. But for you to go to a baseball game and enjoy yourself with a family of three or four, you're spending a week's money, you know, and when a crunch comes, no matter what it is, you know, black families just don't have the kind of money to spend on sports as much as the other groups. You know, it's just that it is hard for a black family to go out to a baseball game, a family of four or five, and to try to enjoy themselves and to park a car, to buy all the kids a hot dog or hamburger, and buy a decent seat. You're talking about them spending a lot of money. So I just think that they've driven the price up so that they don't try to encourage minorities to come to baseball games. That's one of the reasons why I think that you don't see as many minority kids in particular coming to baseball games. And I think that's a sad thing because I think that kids need to come to a baseball game.
Well, is there a way to bring the ticket prices back down?
I think it's a way to bring it back down, but somebody got to figure out how to bring the salaries back down. That's the most important thing, you know. That's the most, you know, players need, I have no gripe about players making the kind of money that they're making. But I think that when you look at the overall picture of baseball, you're saying that baseball is way out of line with other people. That's what they're doing, the same thing. You know, when you see players making the kind of money that they're making. And I'll tell you a little story without telling you what happened. I remember this happened to me about a week ago. I won't tell you where I was, because if you tell you where I was, you can figure out what team it was. But anyhow, I was running. You know, I do a lot of my running inside a ballpark, so I was traveling one day, and I went into a ballpark, and you know, they have what they call a locker where the players put their valuables at, stick their valuables, their pocketbook in there. And so this club had gone on a road trip, and I went in there and opened the valuable box up, and there was $10, $20, $30, almost $150. I grabbed, put it in my pocket. These guys don't want it, so I just put it in my pocket. I carried it upstairs and gave it to a guy. He said, these guys leave that kind of money around, laying around all the day, all the time, you know. And then another thing that they got now, and that you have to listen to me very careful, what happened now is that clubs today, if a player go out and have a good day, what they do, each one of the players put up $100. And if a player have a good day, he probably can go in and off the bulletin board and pick up $400 or $500 in one day, you know. So when you start talking about money, I think that the value of money and some of the things that we are doing now and some of the players and some of the money that they're making is totally out of proportion to what baseball needs to have, because of the fact that if baseball is to survive and if baseball needs markets like Milwaukee, Seattle, and some of these small markets, they got to put things back in line. And what they have to do, they have to make sure that they talk about price control and all the rest of the things. I think that if baseball is to survive, I think that baseball needs to look at a total picture of what needs to be done. I certainly don't believe in what they've done now is making a league, three different kind of leagues, because you look at it and you probably won't, you'll see the World Series in December. Instead of going Christmas shopping, you'd be looking at the World Series in December.
What is your position on baseball team salary caps?
I think that's one way that they can help themselves. It certainly hasn't hurt basketball. I think that salary cap is something that is needed in baseball. Salary cap to me is not detrimental to any particular player, but it tells you one thing, that if you're not doing well, you don't get paid. But the players that are making the good money and having good years certainly need to make the good money. But by the same token, I think that some of the things are going way out of proportion. And I think reason for that is because the owners have made them out of proportion myself.
What was the highest salary you made as a player, and what do you think you could command today by today's standards?
Well, let's just say Ted and I would be partners. We'll shake hands with each other. I think that my highest salary, let me just tell you a story. I started my baseball career in 1957. The first year I hit 280, had to look at my sleeve, 280, 13 home runs, and 69 runs batted in. Now, if a player did that today, that would qualify him for Millionaire Club. I made $5,000 and had a family to raise. I had a little girl. I made $5,000. And sometimes I look back and I say, how did I manage to buy a house, have a kid with $5,000? $5,000 is $5,000. So the next year I hit 313. Next 5 years, I hit well over 300. And for five years, my salary jumped from $5,000 with having great years. I mean, 100 runs batted in and 30-some home runs. I went from $5,000 to $50,000. That was my salary. Now, from $50,000, the next 10 years, or 10 years that I played baseball, it went from $50,000 to $69,000. And from $69,000, they finally decided they were feeling kind of guilty, and my highest salary in baseball was $210,000 a year. Players tipped the clubhouse boy that kind of money today.
What are your thoughts and comments on next year's realignment, and what are the possibilities of a strike?
Well, I think it's terrible. I don't like it. I have not studied it yet, but I don't like the realignment personally. I just think that if you want to do it, you ought to do it right. I think the realignment should look at it, should take the total picture, not just the National League. I think they should take the National League and the American League and say, look, we need to have what we call competition. What would be wrong with you taking the teams in Chicago, the Cubs, the White Sox, the Milwaukee Brewers, the St. Louis Cardinals, the Detroit Tigers, and putting them in a division. You know, first of all, you cut down a lot of travel. And what would be wrong with taking all your West Coast teams and putting them in a division, you know? But what they've done, they've tried to create what they call competition among everybody else. And it's just not going to work. It's just not going to work, because what you're going to have, you're going to have everything one-sided, and players and teams are going to be flying all over the place. So I don't like it.
Regarding the controversy over sports team mascots such as the Braves and the Redskins being offensive to minority groups, what is your personal opinion? And then what is the Braves' official stance on the subject?
Well, I don't like it. I think that you should look at it very carefully and understand other people's feeling, you know. I certainly wouldn't want anybody running out there during the Braves game or during somebody else's game looking like a black Uncle Tom or somebody. It would certainly have some offense to me. So, you know, I think the Indians and anybody else have a legitimate gripe when they say things that they don't want this, they don't want this. And I think that people should take that in consideration. I know that people say, well, you know, we've had this mascot a long time, but still, you know, we're not talking about a long time. We're talking about now. We're talking about people voicing their opinion about certain things, and I think that people ought to understand that. You know, everybody have feelings, and I think that the Indians, whoever they are, whatever group it is, I think they ought to start thinking clearly about this and understand that they got a legitimate gripe.
Is there any player playing now who has a chance to break your home run record?
I don't think so. And the reason I said not that, I'm not saying that. Thank you. I think that the athletes today are very gifted. I think they're great athletes. But I think the one thing that is against them, it was not against me, was the fact that these guys are going to become millionaires at 2 or 3 years. They don't have that desire to go out and play. I had to play. You know, when I was making $5,000 or $10,000, I had a little girl that I had to put in school. I had a wife. I had a home that I had to pay for. And each time that I put my foot under the table, there was two or three other people in there. So I had to do these things. So when you look at it, these players don't have that. You know, they have a home in Malibu. They have a home in Mexico. They have a home in California. And you know, and they play with these different cars. They might buy four or five of these $200 or $300,000 car. Well, hell, I was lucky just to have a car. But you know, I don't think that any player today, if you don't have the desire, a lot of players, you know, have that natural ability to do a lot of things. But I don't think that they're going to play. And just, you know, I hit 755 home runs. You're not going to do that in 15, 20 years. You're going to have to, it's going to take some time and some dedication. It's going to take some time when you're not feeling well. Nowadays, you know, if a player have a headache, he don't play. You know, if he have a hangnail, he stays out. His agent tell him to sit out. You know, I didn't have an agent. You know, when I had a hangnail, I mean, many days. In fact, we were talking about this just a moment ago when Philadelphia had that big lead. We went into Philadelphia, and I had a cracked ankle. I didn't know it was a little bone in my ankle that was cracked, but no swelling in the ankle. And I played the three games out there with a broken ankle. Now, you know, so it's not that I'm telling the players to do that, but I'm just saying that I was doing that because I knew that I had to do well because of my salary drive. I had to make a salary drive, but you don't hear those words anymore.
What do you think of athletes who participate in two professional sports?
Good luck, Dion. It's tough, you know, and I think that it depends on who they are. You know, for example, I think that if you look at a guy like Bo Jackson, nothing against Bo, he's a tremendous athlete, he's done well. But, you know, sometime if you're not going to take care of yourself, Mother Nature will automatically do it for you. So I think that in some cases, in Bo Jackson's case, for example, I know if any of you were watching the game, he was not hit that hard, you know, and it just somehow he was just not in shape. So I'm not saying that just because you were playing two sports, but I think that if you're going to concentrate and do as well as you should do, I think you ought to give strict attention and just focus in on one sport. And I think that playing baseball really is a tough game. People probably don't realize it, but it's a tough game. When you have to play 162 games and go out there every day and focus your attention on who the pitcher is because you're facing different pitchers, I think it's just a lot different than playing football once a week, because the coach can kind of gear you up for that one game. But, you know, it's just tough for you to concentrate two sports and try to do the very best that you can.
Considering everything that you've talked about so far today, would you rather be playing now or back when you were in the game?
I don't know. You know, I've stood up here a long time and talked about money, but I am very glad the fact that I played in the area in which I played in. And I'll tell you the reason why. I didn't make as much money as these players made, but sometimes money isn't everything. I played in an era that if you look back at some of the players that I played against, like Mickey Mantle, Sandy Koufax, Bob Gibson, and some of the great athletes. I mean, it's going to be hard for anybody in this room or anywhere else to find a collective of ball players in the 50s in which I played in, that most of those guys in the Hall of Fame, that you know, you can think back, you know, the Willie Mays, the McCovey, the Billy Williams. You can go on and on and on and just name ball players, ball player, ball player. So, you know, yes, I would have loved to have made as much money as some of these players. No question about that. But still, as I said before, money isn't everything. And sometimes you have to say, well, you know, when you're no longer here, at least your grandchildren can say, hey, my father played in some of the best competition that was ever in baseball. So I'm glad that I played in the era in which I did.
Dugout clearing brawls are turning baseball into an imitation of hockey. And what do you think that should be done about violence?
Well, I think it should be cleaned up, because what I think it is, it's taking away the effectiveness that pitchers can pitch inside. I remember that, you know, a pitcher has a certain amount of the plate that belongs to him. The other part belongs to you. Well, you know, what's happening now is that most of the players don't know how to get out of the way of an inside pitch. Well, I was taught how to do that. I was taught that because every day I had to get out of the way of an inside pitch, you know. But most players today just don't know how to get away from the ball inside. And when you hit them, you know, they decide that they're going to go out there and run and challenge somebody. So I'm glad that Nolan Ryan stood up for people like myself.
Who were the pitchers who gave you the most trouble?
Well, not too many. We had an understanding. No, seriously. Kurt Simmons, I know most of you probably heard of Kurt Simmons. Kurt Simmons gave me a lot of trouble. And a lot of people said, well, he was a left-hand pitcher. He was a, and when I got in the league, he had a terrible accident. He was out mowing the lawn, I guess, and something happened to his little toe, I guess. But the next year, he lost his fastball. He used to always threw me a lot of junk. When I said junk, threw me a lot of bloop pitches and things like that. But he gave me more trouble than anybody. You know, I can't think of anybody else. We had a very good understanding with the rest of them. You know, I hit them sometime and they hit me, you know. But that's the way it goes.
Women make up a large number of fans. How about more women in the front office?
I think it would be great. No question about it. I think that women deserve to have every shot to do anything that they want to do. Anything that they want to do. There's absolutely nothing wrong with women working in the front office in baseball. I know that in some cases, I think Detroit have one as a comptroller over there. I think that some of the other clubs have one. But that's room for women, no question about that. And I'd like to see more women come into baseball.
With free agency, players constantly switch from one baseball team to another. Does this reduce fans' loyalty to teams?
I don't think it reduced fans' loyalty, but what I think when kids look at it, you know, it's hard for you to identify what player is with whom. You know, for example, when Reggie Jackson went into the Hall of Fame, he didn't know what uniform he was going to wear. You know, he'd been with so many clubs. When you identify yourself, you know, the first thing you think about, Joe DiMaggio, you think about the Yankees. You think about Ted Williams, you think about the Boston Red Sox. So I think that the identification that young people have now with certain clubs have lost that simply because of free agents.
What do you think of the DH, AstroTurf, and Dome Stadiums?
Well, I think AstroTurf is good in some ways. I think in baseball, it's better than in football because, you know, those guys get skin burned and all those other things may happen to them. You know, the DH, I think it's been well received in the American League, but I've always said that if it's going to be in the American League, it should be in the National League. I think it should be uniform. I don't like the DH itself, but I think that if you're going to have it, I think that it should be good for both leagues.
What can professional athletes do during their careers to prepare for a life after retirement?
That's the hardest thing, I guess, for an athlete to do, because they all think that people are going to go on clapping for them. The 15,000 fans are going to continue to go out to the ballpark wishing them well. And I think it's harder for an athlete to know when he's finished, to say, well, I got to hang it up. I got to do something else. And most athletes, I'm not saying now, I think athletes today are more prepared for life than they were when I was playing, simply because they couldn't afford to do it. You know, right after the season, you had to go to work because you wasn't making that much money. But I think that athletes today are preparing themselves more today than they were, say, 20 years ago. And it makes me feel good because it is tough. You know, I've been out of baseball now. It was 20 years come April 8th since I hit the home run. And to make that adjustment into the business world and to do something else, believe me, it is quite different. People just don't understand that, and athletes just don't understand that. Because when you make that adjustment, you're in a real world, buddy, and you have to think like the businessman think. And I just say that a lot of the athletes today are making that transition, but a lot of them didn't, say, 20 years ago.
Before I ask the final question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation from the National Press Club, the traditional mug.
Thank you.
And until you do get to the White House, we'll bring the White House to you with Eye on Washington, The Presidents Who Have Known Me by George Thames.
Thank you.
The final question is there any hope for bringing baseball to D.C.?
I asked that same question. I think baseball deserved to be in D.C. How can you not have baseball in the national capital? You know, really should be here. Really should be here.